If you live in the United States, there's a decent chance you're going to have someone knock on your door proselytizing at some point. It could be some local mainline Christian church, that obviously is an option. It could be some wacky sect you've never heard of. But the two groups most known for it are the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses. Both of them fit into that group of all-American religions that are outside the mainstream, somewhat based on Christianity. They're both restorationist in that they claim to be restoring the beliefs and practices of the true Christian church as it existed in the early days, but they have a lot of distinctive features not shared by other Christian sects, and most Christians consider them to be heretical. But it's an important question because the two of them can be confused. They're both quasi-Christian groups that go around knocking on doors, and it's not hard to see why they get confused if most of your experience with them is a short interaction with them on your doorstep or seeing them on your college campus handing out pamphlets. They'll ask you if you're interested in Jesus or interested in going to church. They won't tell you about the weird parts of their religion up front. If you're wondering, the most reliable way I've found to tell them apart is that Mormon missionaries have name tags that say elder or sister on them, while Jehovah's Witnesses don't wear name tags. But there's definitely more differences than that. If the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy had an entry comparing Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, it would say that they are almost, but not quite, entirely unlike each other. I mean that. They're basically inversions of each other, both in history and in the doctrine. The Jehovah's Witnesses started a bit later. They don't have nearly as much of the place in the culture that Mormons do, and there are five times as many Mormons as Jehovah's Witnesses in the US, but it may be more likely for the average American to encounter a witness than a Mormon, all of which are mostly because the Jehovah's Witnesses have no Utah. There's no place where the majority of the population are Jehovah's Witnesses. To put the history of the Jehovah's Witnesses very briefly, in the late 1800s, in Pennsylvania, a couple hundred miles from where Mormonism had started half a century before, a preacher named Charles Taze Russell made predictions about when Jesus would come back based on interpretations of Bible verses and measurements of the Egyptian pyramids. He developed a following known as the Bible Students Movement, but it wasn't really a sect yet. It didn't have official meeting places or a liturgy, and was mostly just an loosely organized bunch kept together by the magazine circulated by Russell's Watchtower Bible and the Tract Society. Russell kept on predicting the rapture again and again. The first time he said Jesus would come back was April 1878, and when that didn't happen, Russell didn't take it as a big deal. The news reported that his followers would be doing a Jonestown, but nope, that night he'd gone to bed early, having assumed that he was probably wrong long beforehand. The way I interpret his reaction was that he was just throwing 1878 out there as one of several potential dates, and well, there's that one crossed off. Russell later came to believe the Second Coming had actually happened even earlier, in 1874, but that Jesus had ascended directly to heaven and was given, quote, rulership and dignity and kingdom, and the end times would begin in 1914. Well, something big, unexpected, and apocalyptic did in fact happen in 1914, so maybe Russell was right. He began feverishly touring the country, preaching nonstop, though he was now in his 60s. The 24/7 schedule did a number on Russell's health, and he died in 1916 on a train traveling through Texas. After Russell's death, Joseph Franklin Rutherford, a lawyer and former atheist who had found Russell to be the only honest and credible religious leader he'd ever met, was the one to inherit the remaining movement. Like Brigham Young for the Mormons, Rutherford was arguably more important than the movement's founder, including actually changing the organization's name to the Jehovah's Witnesses, as well as instituting doctrines they're known for today, like a prohibition on celebrating holidays and participating in politics. So they're both 19th century Christian restoration movements from the northeastern US. They both like knocking on your door. They're both non-Trinitarian and have other idiosyncratic interpretations of Christianity, like claims of a mystical connection to ancient Egypt for both of them. Egypt was so big in the 19th century, Westerners were crazy about Egypt. But in terms of what the adherents are like, the two big made-in-USA neo-pseudo-Christian sects are like inversions of each other. Mormons have a strongly education-forward culture and unusually high college attendance rates, possibly because of their New England Puritan roots. Witnesses are discouraged from any higher education. Mormons go on either 2 or 1.5-year missions, usually when they're young, and usually just the men, but almost all witnesses proselytize their entire lives. Witnesses have stronger prohibitions on participating in civic society than even Quakers. They don't serve in the military, run for office, vote, or even say the Pledge of Allegiance, while Mormons are very nationalist, very overrepresented in the U.S. military, and especially the CIA, going so far as to proxy baptize U.S. presidents. They've got a solid presence in American politics even outside of Utah. Mitt Romney was the first national major party presidential nominee to be a Mormon, but we'll never see a presidential nominee who's a Jehovah's Witness. Guess that's one less thing to worry about. The Mormon Church doesn't require members to shun people who leave the church. Not saying it's never happened, but it's not a rule they make members follow. The Jehovah's Witnesses do practice shunning, but they've toned it down slightly in recent years due to what they call new light, alternatively called pressure from multiple lawsuits that led to European governments labeling them a dangerous cult. Both Joseph Smith and Charles Taze Russell had strong successors, but that doesn't mean there weren't offshoots. When Joseph Smith died without a clear successor, the Mormon Church split into dozens of denominations, the two most notable that exist today being the one founded by Joseph Smith III, known today as the Community of Christ Church, and a lot closer to mainstream Christian doctrine in most ways, and the Brigham Young sect, known today as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the ones who migrated to the Utah Territory and became the people we talk about when we talk about Mormons. But there were other, smaller sects that broke off, and some of them still exist too, like the Latter-day Church of Christ, who manufactures guns and has ties to the Trump family, which isn't the only small culty sect that manufactures guns and has ties to the Trump family either. Let me know if that's a video you'd like to see. But the Latter-day Church of Christ is an offshoot of the Brigham Young sect, the main one. Today's episode is on a group that goes back to the very first schism, and despite getting overshadowed by Brigham Young's church, had an arguably even more interesting history, involving kings, polygamy, piracy, and a revelation of more plates. And on top of all that, still has believers. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, and their brand new friend, courtesy of this episode's co-writer Brandon Ettinger, Moroni the Taper. Imagine how much your entire life would be shaken if the man you believe literally speaks for God was gone. That's what happened to the Mormon residents of Nauvoo, Illinois, on June 27, 1844. The city had been founded as a Mormon refuge. Joseph Smith was literally the mayor, and by that point it was the second biggest city in Illinois. But the center could not hold. Despite being the mayor, Smith was being held in a jail cell for inciting a riot against the Nauvoo Expositor, a newspaper created by excommunicated Mormons that printed and published about many of Joseph Smith's controversies, especially his secret wives. Polygamy was not yet openly practiced by Mormons at this point. Smith and the town's practicing Mormon majority incited a riot that destroyed the expositor's offices. A warrant for his arrest was put out by Illinois Governor Thomas Ford. Smith was arrested, freed by the municipal court in Nauvoo. Then, after another warrant was issued, both Joseph Smith and several other church leaders all turned themselves in. They were all awaiting trial in a small jail in Carthage, the county seat, when a mob of 200 men broke into the jail trying to kill Smith. Smith returned fire with a wheel-lock pistol he'd smuggled in, before eventually jumping out the window amid a hail of bullets. He was probably already dead before he hit the ground, but that didn't stop the mob from lining him up in an impromptu firing squad, for good measure. If you couldn't tell, Joseph Smith dying wasn't really part of the plan to restore the gospel to the world. In the Gospels, Jesus knows he will die, and him dying is kind of the point. That's not how Mormons view Joseph Smith's death. While Brigham Young eventually became the most widely accepted new leader, Young wasn't nominated to be the successor by Joseph Smith. Smith's older brother Hiram, who was assistant president and right-hand man to the prophet, was killed in the shootout in Carthage as well. Joseph Smith's son was only 11 when his father died, so he obviously wasn't a fit replacement, but later went on to start the Reformed Church of Latter-day Saints, which still exists today as the Community of Christ. Brigham Young occupied no particularly powerful position when Smith died. He was one of the 12 apostles of Joseph Smith, but there were 11 other guys who held the same rank, and Young only succeeded because he was charismatic and knew how to make a deal. They're on to me. One of the other apostles, and the topic of today's episode, was James Strang. And if you accept that Joseph Smith was a prophet, Strang may have the strongest case of being his true prophetic successor. James Strang, much like Joseph Smith, was from central New York. Strang later moved to Wisconsin, on the western frontier of the US at the time, where he practiced law and attended a sermon by a traveling Mormon preacher, seemingly just out of curiosity. Strang did not appear to be especially religious early in his life, and was known for enjoying secular Enlightenment-era thinkers like Thomas Paine. Strang described himself in his youth as a, quote, cool philosopher. He did end up marrying the daughter of a Baptist minister, which generally isn't a good move, according to anyone who's grown up being friends with the kids of Baptist ministers. Pastors' kids are crazy. My co-writer Brandon, who also co-wrote my episode about the Deseret Alphabet, would like to specify that he is himself a pastor's kid. But despite his interest in Mormonism, not raised Mormon. Strang did what many men in new relationships do, and made the personality of his wife his own too. He became a proponent of the temperance movement, which discouraged the consumption of alcohol, tobacco, caffeinated drinks, and too much red meat. The temperance movement wasn't started by Mormons, but it obviously caught on in their circles. Early in 1844, through his connections in the temperance world, Strang went to see Mormon apostle Lyman White preach. And something captivated Strang about the restored gospel. Soon after, he traveled nearly 300 miles to Nauvoo, where he would be baptized by Joseph Smith himself. Enthralled with this peculiar new all-American Christianity, Strang proposed to Joseph and Hiram Smith to start a Mormon community near Burlington, Wisconsin, not far from where he lived at the time. The brothers made him an elder of the church and sent him back to Wisconsin to gather new members. Strang sent back a report a few months later on the prospects of Burlington. It would be one of the last letters Joseph Smith ever received. James Strang, despite being baptized only a few months before Joseph Smith's death, was very dedicated to the church. Mormons were already gaining an infamous reputation by then, so this wasn't a low-stakes move to just half-ass practice the faith. You couldn't be sort of a Mormon, the way you can't be sort of a Scientologist. His conversion had real consequences. While in Wisconsin, a mysterious letter arrived in Strang's hands, claiming to be from the late prophet Joseph Smith. It was postmarked by the Nauvoo Post Office, June 19, 1844, a week before Smith's death. The letter became known as the Letter of Appointment, and Strang interpreted it to mean that he was Smith's chosen successor. The text mostly consists of Smith, or whoever really wrote it, giving his endorsement to Strang's plans of a Mormon settlement in Wisconsin, in ridiculously florid biblical purple prose. "And now, behold, my servant James J. Strang hath come to thee from far for truth, when he knew it not, and hath not rejected it, but had faith in thee, the shepherd and stone of Israel. And to him shall the gathering of the people be, for he shall plant a stake of Zion in Wisconsin, and I will establish it. And there shall my people have peace and rest, and shall not be moved." But it also includes passages in which Smith describes a dream that seems to predict his impending death, which is not something mainstream Mormons believe he was capable of doing, even though he was a prophet. Anyone can view transcripts of this letter. It's currently in the possession of Yale University. They've uploaded pictures of the entire document online for anyone interested. Scholars all confirm that it was definitely sent from Nauvoo, but likely isn't in Smith's handwriting. That said, he did use scribes a lot, like when he wrote the Book of Mormon. I linked the letter and some things Joseph Smith definitely wrote for you to all compare and come to your own conclusions, but thousands of Mormons, including some of Smith's relatives, were convinced that Strang was the true successor, just by this letter. It's entirely possible that the letter really was from Smith, but it was only granting Strang leadership over his planned Mormon commune in Wisconsin, not the whole church. The text of the letter never directly says Strang will be Smith's successor, which if Strang wanted to forge something, you'd think it would. Or it's a cleverer forgery. To push the balance of the scale more towards Strang being the true successor, Strang also claimed that before he received the letter, an angel, unnamed, appeared the moment Smith died and anointed him as the next prophet. As you can imagine, these claims were not too popular with people like Brigham Young. While other prominent Mormons, like Sidney Rigdon, also attempted to form their own church, James Strang was the main threat to Brigham Young's power plays. Unlike Young, he had real evidence Smith intended him as a successor. When Young took his followers to Utah, it was just as much to get away from the other Mormon successor sects as it was to get all the Mormons away from the hostile U.S. government. Strang was swiftly excommunicated, albeit with a bright future in store. He and his new followers made a pilgrimage to their new home in Voree, Wisconsin, a settlement near Burlington that Strang had founded and named. Where he got the name from is unclear. At the time, it seemed like Strang could easily end up as the true successor, and Brigham Young would be treated by history as the leader of the weird splinter sect. Strang had some big names following him on the road to Voree, three members of the 12 apostles who had been serving as of Smith's death: William and Lucy Mack Smith, the younger brother and mother of the late prophet, were convinced by Strang's testimony and joined, while Smith's son and first wife stayed in Nauvoo. The most important figure in Mormon history convinced by Strang was Martin Harris, who was one of the scribes to help write the Book of Mormon as Joseph Smith translated it from his seer stone in a hat. And yes, that's the Martin Harris featured in the South Park episode. Other than the letter, how was Strang so convincing? Well, in Doctrine and Covenants, another LDS text, Joseph Smith says, "But verily, verily, I say unto you, that none else shall be appointed unto this gift, except it be through him. For if it be taken from him, he shall not have power, except to appoint another in his stead." Gift meaning gift of prophecy, so being the prophet. The Strangites also believe an angel must appoint the next prophet too, and they believe Doctrine and Covenants 43:7 proves this. "For verily I say unto you, that he is ordained of me shall come in at the gate, and be ordained as I have told you before, to teach those revelations which you have received, and shall receive through him whom I have appointed." Brigham Young neither had direct appointments from Joseph Smith, nor an angelic ordination, nor did he even claim to have either of these things. If I'd been there, in the thick of the Mormon succession crisis, and I was a practicing Mormon, I think I'd have weighed the evidence and gone with Strang. This is also a culture that believes angels can and do appear to important people, not just Joseph Smith, but a variety of figures across Mormon history. It's not a hard pill to swallow for the Mormons of Nauvoo. Joseph Smith was all alone, so by extent the only witness to the angel Moroni. Strang was also alone when an angel appeared to him on Joseph Smith's death. A Mormon would have to be really skeptical of Strang's apparition while accepting of Smith's, who both had the same number of witnesses. You can obviously take this in an opposite direction. Brandon knows an ex-Mormon from the mainstream Brighamite church who lost his faith upon realizing that there's just as much evidence Strang wasn't lying as there is that Joseph Smith wasn't lying. In fact, what's really interesting is that Strang might have had more evidence backing up his prophet status than Joseph Smith did. A short time after the Strangites all gathered up in Voree in 1845, numbering 12,000, almost a fifth of the total Mormon population then, Strang announced he had yet another apparition from an angel. This time, he told of another set of plates, just like the ones Joseph Smith found when he was visited by the angel Moroni. Following what the angel said, Strang brought four of his followers as witnesses to his testimony to a local grove of trees. According to his witnesses, in the Midwest autumn of 1845, Strang brought them to a tree and had them inspect it for any sort of disturbances in the ground, like torn up grass, leaves with the wet side up, or any signs of digging. Strang then told them to dig for the plates the angel told him about, and they dug 3 feet down, through heavily rooted dirt that looked undisturbed and pulled out a baked clay case containing 3 new brass plates. These plates, according to Strang, were written in a lost language by an ancient Native American named, hold on to your stovepipe hats, Raja Manchu of Vorido, and translated using the same devices that Smith used, referred to in Mormon scripture as the Urim and Thummim. Quite what the Urim and Thummim were is disputed. Was it a pair of glasses, as often portrayed in Mormon artwork, or the rock in a hat that Joseph Smith used for treasure digging before his experience in the New York woods? Was one of those the Urim and the other one the Thummim? It's not clear, but either way, the angel gave the Urim and Thummim to Strang. He translated the new plates, which told of how this Raja Manchu's people were all slain in battle, and the Raja was the last one recording the story of his people, and how only a true prophet of God will find this record, which isn't too dissimilar to the ending of the Book of Mormon in Moroni chapter 10. Now, the difference between the 3 brass plates Strang found and the gold plates Smith found is that the brass plates were definitely real. Or real in the sense that they were shown to people, even to non-Strangites. The original gold plates, supposedly found by Joseph Smith, were conveniently buried under the Hill Cumorah, where Smith had originally received his vision. The mainstream LDS church now owns the Hill Cumorah and surrounding area, and maintains the plates are still somewhere down there, but nobody has seen them since the very, very early days. And while Strang's plates were eventually lost decades later, the public was invited to see his plates. Among these people was the typewriter inventor, Christopher Latham Scholes, who would later go on to invent the QWERTY keyboard that you're using to leave hate comments with right now. If you type in Dvorak, clearly you're not watching this video because your head is too far up your ass to see anything. Scholes was not a Strangite or Mormon at all, but he was a fan of them. Like me, I guess. He called the Strangites, quote, honest and intelligent, and saw no reason to believe the plates were fake. The testimony of the men, as well as drawings of the plates, got published in the Strangites newspaper, the Vorey Herald. Now let's compare. Everyone open up your Book of Mormon. See, now there's 12 witnesses who said they saw the original gold plates. Easy as that, right? Well, Doctrine and Covenants 17:2-3 says that the witnesses already have to have faith that the plates are real in order to see them. 2. And it is by your faith that you shall obtain a view of them, even by that faith which was had by the prophets of old. 3. And after you have obtained faith, and have seen them with your eyes, you shall testify of them by the power of God. Then they were able to see with their, quote, spiritual eyes, as Martin Harris and David Whitmer both recounted many years later. As for the other witnesses, they were family of Smith or Whitmer. There were some other people who did experience the plates, like Smith's father-in-law, Isaac Hale, who said he was allowed to hold the box that contained them while they were inside, but not take a peek in, or Emma Smith, Joseph's first wife, who could see them concealed under a cloth. While it's true that even though several of these people later left or were excommunicated, none of them recanted their account of seeing the gold plates, but all purported eyewitnesses of Smith's plates either saw them through some mystical vision or picked up a receptacle they were told contained the plates. In other words, nobody actually saw them. Let's compare that to Strang. He had his own set of plates thus far in the story that showed that he was the prophet, and his own set of witnesses, none of whom recanted their testimony either. But they saw him dig up the plates, insisting that it sure didn't look like Strang had buried them there. Nobody had been around to see Joseph Smith dig up his plates, and none of Strang's witnesses were relatives of Strang, and his plates were seen by many people that weren't even followers. Nobody needed spiritual eyes or boxes that supposedly held the plates. They were available for everyone to see. Critics accused not that the plates were not real, but that they were made from a material suspiciously similar to what brass kettles look like. This was also about when John C. Bennett came back into the picture, and of all the colorful figures in the early Mormon church, the most colorful may have been John C. Bennett. Back when Joseph Smith was still alive and the Mormons established Nauvoo, Smith wasn't the town's first mayor. That honor went to Bennett, a doctor and noted breeder of chickens, who helped draft legal documents for the founding of Nauvoo and served as chancellor of a short-lived university there. If you think the Mormons are puritanical, well, Bennett didn't. Early 19th century America had a lot of sects, and those sects had a lot of sex. Some of them, that is. Some of them were more sex negative than the general population. Others definitely weren't. The most famous sex cult of 19th century America, the Oneida community, started right around the same time this was all happening, in upstate New York, less than 100 miles from where Joseph Smith found the plates. Free love and polyamory were well established among the many new ideas sweeping the area, and when Bennett found his way to the Latter-day Saints, he thought they should get in on that. Bennett was probably not the father of Mormon polygamy. Joseph Smith was most likely taking multiple wives by the early 1830s, a decade after he first started having his visions. But that wasn't public information until the last couple years of his life. Polygamy wasn't widespread among rank-and-file Mormons until Brigham Young took his followers to Utah, and Bennett, who joined the church in 1840, was the first prominent Mormon to openly practice polygamy. He called it spiritual wifery, a term borrowed from another, almost entirely forgotten Great Awakening cult leader, one Jacob Cochran, who ran a sect called the Society of Free Brethren and Sisters in 1830s Maine. Cochran was jailed for practicing polygamy and his disciples scattered across the Northeast, a few becoming some of the earliest followers of Joseph Smith. Bennett's vision of polygamy was generally more sex positive than the forms that Mormon polygamy would later take on. He genuinely wasn't married to some of the women he had sex with. Some of them had husbands of their own. Some of the husbands were even aware of Bennett's dalliances and fine with it. He was basically in a polycule, more Portland than Provo. Bennett allegedly used his medical expertise to perform abortions on his spiritual wives who had other husbands, including some who were Joseph Smith's wives. He was even accused of gay liaisons, which may have been true. Look at those epaulettes. But when this came out, before Smith's own polygamous adventures had been made public, before polygamy was written into the law of the Brighamite Church, it sparked a huge backlash, and in 1842, just 2 years after he joined the Mormons and while serving as Nauvoo's first mayor, Bennett was excommunicated. That was how Smith came to be the second mayor of Nauvoo. Given the office's track record, I can't say I'd want to run for mayor of Nauvoo, but the town still exists, albeit not mostly Mormon anymore. Bennett spent the next few years wandering the country preaching against Mormonism, trying to play an Uno reverse card on the allegations against him and directing them against Joseph Smith instead. The public wasn't having it. Not long before Joseph Smith's death, Bennett attempted to address an anti-Mormon rally in Boston, where he was pelted with rotten eggs and caused a riot that trampled several police officers. After Smith died, Bennett came back to Nauvoo, presumably with the completely cynical goal of starting his own successor sect. When that failed, he threw his weight behind Strang, offering to protect Strang's Wisconsin commune by forming a militia called, I'm not making this up, the Halcyon Order of the Illuminati. Yes, the Illuminati. Unlike the leadership structure of Nauvoo, which was based on the US government, Bennett suggested that Borey would instead be a Gilbert and Sullivan-esque monarchy, with high-ranking titles like Chevalier, Earl, and Cardinal, all anointed by King Strang, who would initiate them by rubbing their heads with olive oil, mixed with a touch of phosphorus to make it glow. Strang, who as a teenager had conceived a semi-serious scheme to marry the future Queen Victoria, ate it up. The original plan was for Strang and his followers to stay in the promised land of Wisconsin, but the land there was much more expensive, for reasons detailed in a past episode of mine about the insane land speculation shenanigans of early Wisconsin. And besides, they were starting to attract the wrong kind of attention from the non-Mormon locals. One of Bennett's memos about the Halcyon Order of the Illuminati had leaked to the public, which understandably freaked some people out. It also freaked out the rank-and-file Strangites, because all the royal stuff Bennett had cooked up was kept secret from them, too, and was only for Strang's inner circle. Bennett was excommunicated once again, basically for the sake of damage control, although the fact that he was again up to his old polyamorous hijinks didn't help. Then, Strang and friends went somewhere a bit more remote, Beaver Island, Michigan, dead center between the ring finger of the glove and this secret part we don't talk about. Again, he claimed an angel had led him to the spot. Land on the island was cheap, but still abundant in natural resources, especially timber. There were some people on the island already, but they were just Irish Catholic immigrants and Native Americans. Strang thought both could easily be evangelized. Mormon missionaries, mostly of the Brighamite sect of the church, were already becoming a common presence in England and Ireland, recruiting immigrants to head over to Utah. As for the Native Americans, it was pretty common for early Mormon leaders to assume it would be easy to recruit them. After all, the Book of Mormon is about them, right? That's an interesting alternate history. What if the Mormons had really gone full send on evangelizing Native Americans, and today the majority of Mormons were Native and vice versa? Don't think it could really have happened, but it's fun to speculate. So, in 1847, Strang and some of his followers moved and set up a second stake on Beaver Island. A stake is like the Mormon equivalent of a parish or diocese, a religious administrative area. Strang wanted new followers and sent missionaries out to the rest of the nation to proselytize, and even sent Martin Harris to England in an attempt to gain followers there. With his church growing and spreading out, Strang's family and followers moved to what would become their kingdom. And not much later, in front of over 300 people on Beaver Island, Strang was again crowned the king, this time publicly. Not as king of the island in particular, but as the king of God's church. He was given a crown of tin, a wood scepter, and a robe that he often wore around Beaver Island. The coronation was officiated by the president of Strang's council, a former Shakespearean actor named George Jones Adams. Having a king on the island meant not only a prophet and a theocracy, but new rules. The Strangites weren't the only ones on the island, but that didn't stop their new king from wanting everyone to bow down. Not much later, Strang received another set of plates from an angel. This time they were the plates of Laban, a figure in the Book of Mormon who has a set of plates that Nephi and Laman have to kill Laban to take. Not sure about the pronunciation of any of those figures. The contents of the plates aren't specifically stated in the Book of Mormon. In Mormon folklore, they're said to contain some genealogies and a few more prophecies. Several people saw these plates too when Strang claimed to dig them up, and never recanted their testimonies either, although they were all Strangites. Strang translated these plates into the Book of the Law of the Lord, a Strangite scripture that gives them doctrines and guidance. Just as Moses was given the Ten Commandments, so was James Strang given the Book of the Law of the Lord. It outlines doctrines that the Strangites would live by, with some obvious stuff like how the king would govern and how they would manage infrastructure, but some religious law too. Here's a few of the notable ones. The Strangites worship on Saturdays and not Sundays. Polygamy was A-OK. This was something Strang was originally against, which he used back in Nauvoo to recruit followers to his side instead of Brigham Young's. Later on, when John C. Bennett briefly became the shadow leader of the Strangites, it was his open practice of polygamy that initially turned Strang against him. But apparently God later clarified that it was fine, and Strang ended up having a total of 5 wives. In the Strangite church, women can hold the priesthood, which the mainstream LDS church still doesn't allow women to do. However, women cannot do sacrifices of animals, which were required in the Strangite church at the time. Strang also allowed black people to hold the priesthood too, something their Brighamite relatives wouldn't allow until 1978. Communion is usually done with wine or grape juice. Mainstream Mormons practice it with water instead, because of a revelation from Joseph Smith that clarified it's not important what you use for sacraments, just that it shouldn't be wine because of their rules on alcohol. Mormons ever since have used water to represent the blood of Jesus instead. However, for the Strangites, the Book of the Law of the Lord expands on this point and says fruit juice that is not bought can be used. So the Strangites squeezed whatever fruits were in season for their sacraments. The Strangites have one other distinct and noteworthy belief. Unlike the Brighamite Mormon Church, basically every other Christian sect, and even Muslims for that matter, the Strangites do not believe in the miraculous conception of Jesus, or more simply put, a virgin birth. They believe that Jesus was a mortal man who was sinless and ordained by an angel during his 40 days in the wilderness, in much the same way Smith and Strang were ordained by angels as well. Beaver Island is about 56 square miles, the largest island in Lake Michigan, but still small enough to worry about overusing the natural resources of the island. Strang realized this and enacted some oddly progressive policies that helped maintain the pristine Great Lakes landscape they lived in, but their island wasn't exactly a paradise. King Strang began enacting laws, even though he had no real legal authority, including a law that forced women to dress in only very conservative knee-length smocks and bloomers. If someone didn't comply with this or other rules, King Strang would use public flogging as a punishment. He did not play around with laws or people who challenged him. Polygamy was, again, something that Strang was initially against, which earned him credit with a lot of Mormons, including relatives of Joseph Smith. But since God had clarified that polygamy could be practiced, Strang took four more wives in the early 1850s, which did more to upset the non-Strangite residents, as well as a fair number of the Strangites. Thousands of Strang's followers had left after the John C. Bennett affair back in Wisconsin, and now thousands more left. But some stayed. One of Strang's new wives was named Elvira Field. She's often regarded as King Strang's favorite wife, and she was known to have a striking similarity to Charlie Douglas, the 16-year-old nephew and secretary of King Strang when he went on missions outside of the island. Charlie was Elvira dressing as a man. This all came to a head when King James Strang began demanding tithes from all the island residents and ordered the county treasurer to give them 1/10 of the taxes collected on Beaver Island. As you can imagine, many people did not comply and violence broke out on both sides. The mainstream media was prone to hysteria about Mormons, and the tales of James Strang and his island monarchy began getting exaggerated. Newspapers as far as New England began reporting that Strang and co. were acting as pirates and pillaging ships before killing all their crew, probably based on a real incident where Strang fired a cannon at some drunk islanders threatening him. All of these wild stories eventually reached all the way up to President Millard Fillmore, who demanded the U.S. District Attorney to investigate if King Strang and his followers really were out pirating. Strang and his inner circle were transported to Detroit aboard the USS Michigan, the U.S. Navy's first iron-hulled warship, to be put on trial in 1851. Luckily, Strang was no stranger to the court system. Back in a previous life, before he'd found the LDS Church, he'd been an attorney, so he self-represented and was miraculously able to beat all the charges brought against him. This not only set him free, but gave him a lot of good publicity, and with all the extra children the Strangites were pumping out, they eventually became the predominant demographic on the island. They were able to give King Strang some real and legally recognized power by voting him into the Michigan State Legislature in 1853 and again in 1855 as a Democrat. While in the legislature, he passed a law incorporating Beaver Island as its own county, which he now had legally approved near-total power over, because a majority of the voters were his followers. One of the rules that King Strang enforced on the island with his new power was that alcohol trade would need a permit. The permit could only be granted by, who would have guessed, the Strangite King himself. This law being enacted on an island whose other main demographic was known for its love of alcohol and hatred of the royal family definitely didn't improve the street cred of King Strang. Within a couple years, Strang's political capital had been burnt. The tipping point of this island guerrilla warfare culminated in 1856, when two men, Hezekiah D. McCulloch and Thomas Bedford, men who had become vengeful after being publicly whipped and humiliated by Strang, plotted to kill him. The USS Michigan was again arriving at Beaver Island. The two men procured pistols and hid in waiting for Strang, who was on the docks, to meet with the captain of the Michigan. As the ship pulled into the dock, the two men he had flogged had their sweet revenge. Three bullets hit King Strang in the head, cheek, and spine. Bedford and McCulloch then hopped on the ship and sailed off with the captain and crew. The assassins were put in a local jail on the mainland, where they sat in an unlocked cell until their trial. They were given a fine of $1.25, or about $50 today, before being freed and greatly praised by all the non-Strangites of the island. Strang survived his attack for about 3 weeks. His followers brought him back to Vory, where he spent the remainder of his dying days. If you're thinking the US government was involved with this plot, you're not crazy. There's no direct evidence they were involved, but the kangaroo court trial where they rubber-stamped these guys' innocence, and their warm welcome on the ship that was going to visit Strang, is odd. The Navy being in concert with the assassins isn't a new accusation, but I'll let you all come to your own conclusions. Even as everyone knew he was dying, Strang did not declare a successor. It's a key belief among the Strangites that the lesser cannot ordain the greater. Moroni ordained Smith, and Smith ordained Strang, so now they too were left without a prophet. And with the king dead, the rest of the islanders proved that they were not at all the good guys in this story. A mob from mainland Michigan descended on the island, welcomed by the Irish Catholic islanders. All the remaining Strangites, about 2,600 people, were uprooted from their homes, robbed of almost all their worldly possessions, and crammed onto ships, which dropped them off stranded across the whole Great Lakes. An honest-to-God Michigan pogrom. Many of the notable converts, like Martin Harris and William Smith, went to Utah and joined Brigham Young, and many more of the remaining Strangites joined what was then called the Reformed LDS Church, the one founded by Joseph Smith III and Emma Smith, and which still exists today as a much more normal Christian denomination that doesn't even put much weight on the Book of Mormon anymore. Others went further into the ideological wilderness. Remember that down-on-his-luck actor, George Jones Adams, who crowned Strang king the second time? What Strang was to Joseph Smith, Adams tried to be for Strang. Most of the Strangites were pretty done with the whole successor claimant rigmarole by now, so he didn't get a lot of followers, but he got some. Adams actually wasn't on great terms with the Strangites when Strang died, because he'd already been punished for his drinking problem, an especially big no-no in Mormon land, and purported embezzlement, given that he'd been in charge of Strang's finances. Adams made his way out to Maine, where he started an outfit called Church of the Messiah. Who was the Messiah? Not him, it seemed, and not Strang either. The Messiah was still yet to come. Adams' teachings weren't really Mormon-based either. We've gone far enough down the chain of religious mutations that it sort of bends back around to become normal Christianity again. Adams' key revelation was one that was very well founded in mainstream Christian thought today, that in order for the second coming of Christ to happen, first, the Jews have to return to Israel. While not in the Bible, this proto-Zionism has been pretty common among Protestants for about as long as Protestants have existed. On its own, this isn't really Zionism as it's understood today. Someday the Jews will return to Israel has been a central belief in Judaism for 2,000 years, whereas Zionism is, we should, right now in our current lifetimes, work on doing that. There's still a handful of ultra-Orthodox Jewish groups that are against Zionism because they think that the time isn't right yet and only the Messiah can truly return the Jews to Israel. George Adams, meanwhile, really was an early Christian Zionist. He believed that he could hasten the second coming by getting a bunch of adventurous American Christians together and settling in Palestine, then controlled by the Ottoman Empire, to, quote, prepare it for the arrival of the Jews. Quite how they were supposed to prepare it was unclear, but Adams took it seriously. He changed his name to George Washington Joshua Adams because he aspired to be the founder of a nation like George Washington and the biblical Joshua. He raised thousands of dollars from his followers and bought a 10-acre plot of land outside the city of Jaffa, today's Tel Aviv. 10 acres is about the size of Yankee Stadium, not huge if you're trying to start a country. Adams set off from Boston in 1866, with 157 of his followers, including several families with children. Their territory, bought sight unseen, happened to be right by a dump where the butchers of Jaffa threw out animal remains. They eventually negotiated for a better plot of land, but nobody was used to the ins and outs of desert life. All their crops failed, forcing them to beg for food from the local Arab population. The Ottoman government treated them as illegal immigrants, and one of the encampments was attacked by an angry mob of Arabs. The drinking problem that had gotten Adams voted off Beaver Island all those years ago resurfaced for obvious reasons. Soon he was no help. After a year of sand and near famine, residents began to petition the governor of Maine, the state most of them came from, to send a boat to bring them back. Here's where we get to this forlorn little colony's primary claim to fame. On the ship that ended up picking up about 40 of the colonists to return them to the US, one of their fellow passengers was Mark Twain. He was on a tour of Europe and the Middle East aboard the USS Quaker City, a sidewheel steamer originally used by the US Navy in the Civil War, and after the war, sometimes considered the first cruise ship, taking wealthy Americans on pleasure tours of the Mediterranean. One of these tours was written up by Mark Twain in his book The Innocents Abroad, which was his best-selling book during his lifetime, established his fame as a writer, and is still a fascinating outsider's account of Europe, Egypt, and the Holy Land in the late 1860s. Twain describes his fellow passengers who boarded the Quaker City in Jaffa as, quote, "old Adam's American colony dupes," implying the readers would already have a passing familiarity with George Adams' story. Twain suggests there were scandalous rumors about them, perhaps derived from stories of James Strang's bizarre theocracy, but in real life, they seemed sad and dull. But where were the other hundred-something members of Adams' colony? Some had died from famine and unfamiliar diseases. A few others returned to America later on. One of the survivors of the Arab attack on the village ended up in California and became John Steinbeck's grandmother. A handful stayed indefinitely, and I'm not sure what became of them. Many years later, an American journalist met an old woman from New Hampshire living in a tumble-down shack near Jaffa, insisting she would never return to cold New England. And not everyone lost faith in Strang. Down a two-lane road in the woods of Wisconsin, there's a church with a sign that reads, "Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Strangite," attended by those whose families found their way back to Vory. Brandon and I both tried to contact the church, but as of the recording of this video, there was no luck. He also mentioned the Strangites to some of his friends and family in the area, who said they've never heard of the small church. There's about 100 Strangites left, and they still gather every Saturday. They don't practice polygamy anymore, as that was something only a decree from God could instate. They also don't proselytize, or at least to the extent that they used to. They don't have a prophet, and their mission is now to wait until Jesus returns, or God gives them another prophet. If you're curious, they have a website, and are very welcoming of visitors. Ask them about Raja Manchu of Viroda. I still don't know if we have the full story there.
Want to reach your friend,